Welcome back, listeners. You're listening to EBC Radio. This is 1170 AM. You're listening to Heartbeat. This is an educational program about your health. We air on EBC Radio every second and fourth Saturday of the month. I'm Dr. Dinesh Singhal. I'm an interventional cardiologist. Today we have with us Dr. Jonathan Rosenbluth. He is a medical oncologist and hematologist with Astera Cancer Care. And, you know, for a change, we are paying attention to folks as all of us get older, our needs and the way we approach our patients kind of changes. So even though we've in the past discussed cancers specifically based on the organ system, Dr. Rosenbluth has an interest in trying to focus and incorporate the needs of an aging population within the different kind of malignancy. So we're kind of discussing those aspects. In the first half, we focused a little bit on breast cancer. We're going to move forward to some of the other cancers and look at some of the specifics which impact those malignancies. Again, you can listen to this program on www.ebcmusic.com. And recordings of our show are available on heartbeatradioshow.com. So with that, Dr. Rosenbluth, let's focus a little bit on prostate cancer. You know, it affects largely an older population. And, you know, I think within the last month, I had a relative of mine who's in his 70s. I have a colleague of mine who's in his late 60s. Was diagnosed to have prostate cancer, and everybody kind of goes down and has to deal with these issues of which kind of treatment to go with. So before going there, let's again talk about the recommendations for screening. Who should be screened? Till what age should we get screened? What is the frequency of the screening, and what modality do we use for that?
Absolutely. So when we focus on prostate cancer, I think just like with many other cancers, we have to think about individual decision making when it comes to screening. It should be based on the patient's history, and medical history and family history, because there are patients who are more at risk for prostate cancer in their lifetime than others. So screening should be some element of that involved with the screening decisions. But in general, we usually recommend a yearly prostate exam, as well as a PSA beginning from the age of 55 and over. We would start screening younger than that for patients who've had family histories, and for certain populations, for example, African-American men who tend to have higher risk of early prostate cancer. We generally would recommend screening up until, in this way, yearly prostate exam with a PSA blood test up until the age of 70. For patients over 70, then again, we make individual decisions, and that would be based on that patient's overall health, their life expectancy, and in some cases, personal preference. The reason for this really has to do with the fact that prostate cancer is a disease that grows slowly, and in most cases, and is one that the screening process can often lead to false positives. So it has to be considered as well that patients who are older may be subject to more testing, such as biopsies and so forth, and that has to be considered when it comes to these screening recommendations. But those are the general guidelines we'll use for screening for prostate cancer.
So, you know, I in my practice, the number of people who are in the 90s seem to keep increasing on a daily basis. Mm-hmm. So if I take the age cutoff of 70, and I know you've said it needs to be individual, but I'm just thinking aloud, if somebody is otherwise in good shape, what if they get diagnosed with prostate cancer, and let's assume it's early, and if this is a diagnosis. So let's assume somebody has prostate cancer. They're 71, and we're not doing testing on them annual based on the guidelines. And that prostate goes unnoticed. What's the expected life? Or what's the expected course of this prostate cancer? Will they outlive that cancer? You know. So yeah.
So I think there's a very interesting statistic that has come up, which is that far more people tend to die with prostate cancer than die from prostate cancer. And that means to say that there are many men in their older years who may very well have that diagnosis of prostate cancer, but because of the nature of the disease for most people, in most cases, they tend to have other health problems that still remain in the forefront. And the important thing is to, in those situations, is to be careful about over-treating. And because again, we that's our first go-to, of course, is to think about what do we do for somebody? How do we help them? And of course, the cancer diagnosis is one that's the scariest, one of the scariest of all. I always find that it's very important with someone who's diagnosed with prostate cancer at an older age to say, we're going to stop, we're going to sit, and we're going to talk about this and make an informed decision about what we're going to do about it. It's considered today to be a very appropriate and realistic approach to do what we call watchful waiting. And that watchful waiting really means keeping an eye on the patient's disease, but not necessarily start them on treatment. That means if we're following a PSA that's elevated, for example, or they were having some urinary symptoms that were problematic to them and the diagnosis was made, but those urinary symptoms are under control, we don't necessarily have to go with an aggressive treatment plan right away, but rather to watch and wait and see how the cancer behaves to determine what to do. We don't necessarily miss an opportunity in that situation to treat them, and we can treat at a later point with good effect.
So let's take an example of someone, and I know someone who's right now in the same position. He's probably around 75, and he just got diagnosed with prostate cancer. So let's just, that patient comes to you, they decided to do a PSA, and now they have early prostate cancer, which hasn't spread. So right. Kind of walk through your approach to a patient like that, 75 right. years old.
Right. So, my approach to this patient, first and foremost, would be to learn more about that patient in general, learn more about their health problems, their health history, to determine what kind of individual at age 75 we're dealing with. If we're talking about an individual who could be very vulnerable to aggressive treatments, even surgery, for example, a prostatectomy, then that may not be the right option for them. So, of course, our treatment choices would be surgery, as we talked about before, radiation, and medical therapy. And these are the different options we have. Sometimes combinations of the three can be involved. In prostate cancer, you actually can choose one of those three to start with in many cases. But they each carry with them their own potential risks. So I would approach this individual and make sure they understand what those risks are, what the benefits and risks are. For example, a prostatectomy can have the highest curative potential of all of the different choices that are available. And for someone who has a very high predicted longevity, say 10, 15 years or more, that could be a good option for them. Robotic surgeries are getting very good these days. They're able to do what we call nerve sparing, which means that the older surgeries used to have very high risks for patients developing incontinence of urine, and having problems with sensation problems and things of that sort. And the prostatectomies that are done these days that are done by robotic surgeries have much lower risks of these things happening. When we deal with radiation therapy, radiation has a few different forms. We have external beam, where the radiation is treated from the outside in. And then we also have what's referred to as brachytherapy, which involves the use of radioactive seeds that are implanted directly into the prostate. Very useful for prostate cancer that's local and right just on the inside, where you want to have less risk of complications of the radiation affecting some of the areas nearby the prostate. So these are treatment options as well that we provide to this patient and discuss. They have a higher risk of recurrence in those cases, but again, there's much lower risk of complications that surgery would have. And finally, again, if we're dealing with someone who has a higher risk for these treatment options, we may consider hormone therapy. And hormone therapy is medical therapy that we're using. I mentioned hormone therapy with breast cancer and prostate cancer. We have also hormone therapy that has much lower risk compared to chemotherapy for complications. No drug is perfect, so it has its own risks involved as well, but it is generally much better tolerated than chemotherapy, involves much less frequent treatments. In some cases, they can be given only once every 6 months with some special long-lasting treatments that we have. And the side effects that are there can still be a problem, but we assess the patient to make sure they're doing well. So issues like fatigue, increased risk for cardiovascular disease, loss of bone density, and sometimes loss of libido and sexual drive can be problems with hormone therapy. But we don't have the problems that chemotherapy has, such as nausea, vomiting, weight loss, hair loss, and general weakness and risk of hospitalizations as well.
You know, so correct me if I'm wrong, but I've had this impression about prostate cancer. Because it's slow growing, and you made a point that more people die with prostate cancer than because of prostate cancer. And because it seems like all three treatments, because of its slow growing nature, kind of in some ways get you to the same point that this is one cancer where there is no clarity of some kind as to how best to treat it, and depends on who you wind up being with. Because I've seen my patients, I have another patient who has a significant, you know, he's had open heart surgery, he has recently just had a valve replacement, has prostate cancer, and I can see him struggling through, he's in his late 70s, and, you know, unfortunately, I'm not well equipped to advise him, mm-hmm. and he's struggling with the same issues. So is my impression wrong that this is one where depending on who you talk to, you just come up with a myriad options as to what to do?
I think you hit on it exactly right, which is that prostate cancer happens to have a plethora of really good treatment options. And these treatments have really advanced in their technology so well that they've surpassed the researchers' ability to compare and contrast them. Right. I mean, when we want to see, well, which one is better? Well, we can have an opinion, but we're driven by data when we want to say, well, this one's proven to be better, and we want to have comparisons. Comparison studies are hard to come by in prostate cancer, they've developed much more slowly than, say, they have with breast cancer. In breast cancer, the research is much more abundant than it is in prostate cancer. And maybe for a number of different reasons, because you have different disciplines working on different areas of treatment, they all have shown very strong benefits for our patients. But to say, rightly pointed out, to say that one is clearly the winner compared to the others, no, we're not there. We don't have that. And more research is coming. And again, especially when we deal with older individuals, because most older patients are included less in these clinical trials. So we have even less data to show for them to say, well, patients at your age are going to do better in this treatment versus that one. So that's why when that happens, I like to have the patient involved in the decision making. Let them hear it through and let them and hear what they think about their about the choices.
And they'll be as confused as the physicians themselves are. One final question on prostate cancer. So from a from a screening perspective, you said the PSA and a regular exam. You know, the reality of the matter is that most people either are not going to a urologist and or the providers are not, or the physicians are not doing a regular physical exam. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's just the reality of the situation. And the patient's uncomfortable getting an exam. And you know, the skill set of who's doing it is also a driving factor. So is a PSA a reasonable surrogate and is a reasonably reliable surrogate? Because that's easy to do. And I get to see that that happens more often than not, as opposed to a physical exam.
It's true. Yeah, the PSA really has, you know, our academic bodies are very stringent when it comes to the use of blood tests as cancer screening. You know, there are a number of other markers, you know, PSA is what we would think of as a marker, a number of other markers that have emerged over the years as being useful tools for the oncologist to follow cancer patients. The problem is that sometimes patients sometimes in the medical field will look at a screening mark, at a marker as a potential screening tool. A classic example would be a CA125, which is for ovarian cancer, or has been shown to be elevated. But the problem with a marker, at least what we really need is we need that marker to be very specific, not just sensitive to be able to pick up the disease, but specific enough so that it avoids having a lot of false results. The PSA is still probably the closest one we have to the only one really that we can include as a screening tool. Obviously, if one is not able to get if it's difficult to get a routine rectal examination for a prostate screen, then a PSA would suffice, and that's usually felt that way. But I think patients should be less apprehensive about that. It can be a very, very important tool. And there's nothing wrong with asking their doctor for that as well.
Very good. So we have about less than nine minutes left. Let's focus on another common cancer, and that's colon cancer. So let's again talk about what's the screening recommendation over the age of 65 for colon cancer.
Right. So the general recommendation is, again, to begin with, is that at this point now, patients over the age of 50 should have their first colonoscopy. And then beyond that, depending on the findings from that colonoscopy, we would recommend repeat colonoscopies every 5 to 10 years. That would depend on whether polyps were found on that particular colonoscopy that was done and so forth. In general, the recommendation for colonoscopies are agreed upon up until the age of 75. Beyond that, from 75 up till 85, it really, again, has to do with the patient's overall health and the results of prior screening. And I would also include, I think, based on that patient's potential risk from their family history. Medical oncologists are very keen on asking about family history of cancers. There is a sizable population of colon cancer patients who develop that cancer because of genetics. And that is important from a screening standpoint, how frequently they're screened and so on, and how late they'll be screened until because of that risk. The fact is that one thing that's interesting about colonoscopies that I like to point out to patients who are apprehensive about that one as well, is to say the colonoscopy is the one screening tool that not only can detect a cancer, but can actually remove a cancer or a potential cancer, because those polyps are what become cancer later on. And if you remove that polyp, you've actually potentially reduced that risk of cancer developing. And that's why those screening tests are performed so with such wide intervals as well, because these polyps take a long time to develop into a cancer. I think it's important to tell patients, the other thing about a colonoscopy is that compared to other screening tests that we have, say breast cancer, prostate cancer, even lung cancer screening, say CAT scans and so on, is that the colonoscopy has the highest risks because of anesthesia, because of risk of complications, bleeding, perforation, things like that. So it really has to be taken very carefully for patients to decide at a certain age whether they want to undergo those risks. And again, the benefit would be for something that could develop into a cancer years later. So again, depending on a patient's expected lifespan longevity, once they reach an age, say 75, 80 years old, you may want to think twice about continuing those colonoscopies because the benefits for it are really going to be much, much later down the road.
So if somebody was, let's say, 85 and they're really in great shape, you know, they're going playing the golf and they have history of families living, parents living into their mid 90s, are you saying that based on this rate of growth, it may not be that most people would not recommend that person going through a colonoscopy?
I think that would be a fair thing to say, that there would be a lot of pause about whether you'd want to put a otherwise healthy, you know, person who's in good health or does not have any significant problems at that point. Now, it would be very different if someone was having symptoms, sure. Or say they were found to have anemia from bleeding or something along those lines. But otherwise, if they're in very good health, you have to think very carefully about that. Fortunately, we also do have other screening tools that are available. Again, the colonoscopy still is the gold standard of screening tools. But some of the listeners may know that there are other types of screening tools out there for colon cancer. For example, a test called Cologuard, which is a test of the stool that looks for the presence of cancer-related proteins in that sample. So that's different from, say, just looking for blood in the stool, which is the old test that we would do on the stool, just looking for the presence of blood. But a Cologuard test is really a more sophisticated test, but again, has not been proven yet to be as reliable as a colonoscopy in detecting early cancers. But one could consider that because it's a non-invasive test as a replacement once they reach a certain age and they want to avoid the risks of the colonoscopy. The only problem they have to understand, it's always important to go forward, is to say, well, a Cologuard test may not be as specific as I mentioned before, which means that false positives can happen there. And actually they can happen with quite a high frequency, as much as 25%. And so to understand that a positive Cologuard test could lead to a colonoscopy to make a true diagnosis, and again, it may be a false result.
Now, colonoscopies are suggested every 10 years. Is there a recommendation for the Cologuard? Or it's not in the guidelines?
Not quite. We don't have an exact recommendation there because, again, the main bodies have not talked about that as a definitive screening tool.
Got it. We have less than 3 minutes left. Actually, I could say about 2.5. Let's take an example of a 75-year-old who comes in with a diagnosis of colon cancer, who's otherwise in reasonable health. How's your approach to a person, at that age?
Well, I think some of the difficult decision-making has to be when we have a patient at that age who has a colon cancer that was caught at an advanced enough stage. That was detected at an advanced enough state where chemotherapy would be a consideration. And if chemotherapy is a consideration for what we call adjuvant therapy, then it becomes a very important conversation to talk about the benefits that chemotherapy can provide. And we have different kinds of chemotherapy regimens, different degrees of intensive levels of the chemotherapy. And often what I will do is talk very frankly with patients at that age to say, we have to think about the pros and cons here of using chemotherapy now, whereas the chemotherapy certainly can help, we may not want to use the most aggressive regimen available. And we may want to consider some less aggressive regimens where the benefit difference may only be by a few percentage points, say 3-4% difference when proven, but the risk of side effects can be much higher than that. So that's also where I think getting a full assessment on the patient, their preferences, understanding their overall health can help us make those decisions because there is no one right answer there.
Well, we have less than a minute. If you maybe just want to give just a broad perspective of some of the challenges other than the choice of drugs or the choice of treatment you face, just from an age perspective, just maybe 30 seconds of what you have to deal with and a person in an older age.
Right. So what I often tell patients when I want to assess them is that we really have a lot of questions we want to know about them to help us determine the best treatment for them, the best way to manage. And that involves knowing everything, including their level of nutrition, their level of social support. We want to measure their cognitive function. So we want to see, are they going to be able to handle some of the very sophisticated conversations that we're going to have that are complex? So these are very important parts of the assessment for our patients when deciding on what drugs to use, what treatments to give. The other thing is to know what other medicines they're on, because polypharmacy is such a big issue these days with our older patients. We're going to be adding on more and more drugs, and we don't want those drugs to interfere or interact. Sometimes we don't even need some of those drugs that they used to be on anymore. For example, blood pressure, which tends to drop during cancer treatments. Cholesterol levels tend to improve, especially if our patients aren't eating in the same pattern that they normally would be. Even diabetes medicines sometimes can be modified or withdrawn or taken away because blood sugars may improve. So these are very important parts of assessing the elderly patients.
Very good. Well, Dr. Rosenbluth, thank you so much. I think you added a different dimension to looking at cancer and factoring in the challenges we face as we all get older. Thank you.
Thank you very, very much.
Okay, folks, you were listening to Heartbeat. This is EBC Radio. This program came to you on 1170 AM, and we'll be back with another edition of Heartbeat. We have this show every second and fourth Saturday of the month. I'm Dr. Dinesh Singhal. We were talking to Dr. Rosenbluth, who is a cancer specialist, and hope you'll tune in for the next edition of the show.
Thanks.